Welcome to the Healthy Wealthy Podcast, Lifestyle Medicine Works. I'm your host, Johannes Wisslinger, founder of Healthy Wealthy and Lifestyle Prescriptions University. Now, in this podcast, it's very different than probably the podcast you've heard so far, because we want to have outrageously honest conversations about lifestyle medicine, health coaching, and especially also healthcare 3.0. And we're going to invite leaders, best-selling authors, researchers. And what's really important for me is that we really have honest discussions, right? It seems like these days it's very difficult to listen to opposing opinions, maybe have different opinions. And then really that's what science is supposed to be. And so one of the things that we really pay attention to and, allow opinions, allow different points of view, because I think that's how we learn. That's how we can grow, not just individually as a society, but also in terms of research and being innovative. And to me, healthcare 3.0 is where we need to be. And other podcasts, we talk a lot more about that. So I'm so honored that Dr. Yamani is joining us today. Hi, Dr. Yamani, how are you?
I'm doing great, Johannes. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you so much. Now, to introduce you, basically, you're a board certified internal medicine physician. You are a value-based primary care provider. You're specialized in lifestyle medicine. You also an Ornish program provider. You have three very, very successful practices and big practices with a lot of patients in Florida. And, also, I think you do research, and we're going to talk a lot more about that in terms of what's the problem with healthcare, right? And we all agree there is none. I mean, it's all good and dandy, right? There's nothing we need to fix here. But I think everybody agrees it needs to be fixed. The question is, what are we going to do? So welcome again.
Thank you. Thank you again. It's my honor. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm sure we're going to have a wonderful discussion today.
Yes. So let's start kind of big picture, because I'm personally a very big picture guy. I need to see what's going on from a big picture perspective, because without knowing that, it's hard to really look into the details. Where's medicine right now? What are the key or main issues from your perspective?
All right. So again, thank you, Johannes, for discussing something like that. It's very important to understand the overall picture. And I really like the idea that you discussed that, we need to understand sort of opinions from all the stakeholders, right? So right now in United States, we have a crisis. We have a crisis in healthcare. However, the reform or innovations is the normal thing in healthcare. The country is in healthcare reform since way back when, maybe 100 years now. So, most of these reforms, it is limited and it is confined mostly to the administrative side of it, to the governance side of it, right? So people, it is very hard to have any innovation or change or collaboration translate down to the common people, right? So in a way, if you want to divide, broadly speaking, you can divide medicine into two parts. One is the delivery of the care. That is an issue. And one is how the medicine is being practiced. So those are the two things. When we talk about, and again, it is in my mind, when we talk about lifestyle medicine, we talk about the way we practice medicine. And it is mainly confined to the practitioners, providers, doctors, nurses, health coaches. When I say provider, means all of us who are in the trenches, or the frontline worker. Technically, we are all frontline workers, right? So we kind of discuss among ourselves, and our concern is how we can practice medicine or how it should be. So the thing is, we are busy in the debate of how the medicine should be practiced, which is kind of a one aspect of it, maybe 50%, I would say. Rest of the 50% is how the medicine is being delivered. And governance and the delivery of medicine control the providers, because in many ways it has been controlled. So one doctor, you know, can come and say, oh, I have this method of treatment and all that. And that doctor can create his empire, but it is very limited in the bigger.
So why do you believe it's so difficult to change? I mean, you know, one of our next guests is Dr. Robert Pearl, and he said in one of our summit talks, you know, for 30 years, not much has changed in medicine. There is so much talk, as you said, about it. But in reality, if you look down to, as you say, this how it's practiced and delivery of medicine, a little twinkle here and there, but it's not really changed. Why is that? What's so difficult there?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I think nobody knows exactly. There are a lot of speculation, a lot of ideas, a lot of suggestions out there, like Peter Drucker, who is, you know, one of the famous, you know, fund manager in the United States and one of the, you know, wise men, you can say. He described it that healthcare system is a very complex system, right? So the thing is, by nature, it's a complex system. First of all, we need to understand that, you know, it's almost like an 800-pound gorilla. You know, it's hard. And then I say it is the providers. You know, I think part of it is us doctors, because when we trained from medical school 20, 30, 40 years ago, we had this idea of practicing medicine, right? And then as a physician, I can attest to that. You know, I want to come and do a routine care, what I have learned in medical school, because the compliance and pressure of reporting and all those things is such that if I see my 20, 30, 40 patients a day, I'm done. I don't have time to think. There's no brain left after that to think out of the box, actually. You know, so you know, like the famous saying about the two small fishes in the ocean. One was asking other that, you know, I heard about water. What is water? So sometimes you go so deep into it, right? Like into the weeds, as we call it here, that you forget that why you are in here for the first place. So I think, personally speaking, the stakeholders are not motivated. Plus the thing is, there is a robust financial system. It's already established, right? There's so many stakeholders which is getting benefited by the system. They don't like that. They don't like that their income stream get disconnected by some way. I think nobody would like to do that, right? I mean, you would not, if I have a way of, you know, generating income, which is very established and quote unquote working, I don't want to change that, right? But the thing is, I don't know. I mean, that's where we can start. So I always think it is the delivery system. What we, you know, let's say, typically speaking, in a person's life in the United States of America, if you take it from age zero to, let's say, 85 years, and patient die average around this time, the amount of dollar that we spend in that person's life in last 2 years is more than we spend in his entire or her entire life, right? So the focus is on that last 2 years and how to give them six more months of prognosis and all that kind of thing. The whole system is designed for that, right? So the thing is, we, because of the payer system is like that. If you are a healthcare manager today, and if you own a health plan, for example, and if I ask you, Janice, can you do that? Can you take 15% of that money and start spreading in the rest of his life and start paying people who are working to improve health, like upstream care, right? You go in the, right now we are sitting at the end of the stream and trying to prevent people from, you know, going into the ocean, right? You know, and drowning and all that. So if you go upstream, you're gonna, as a leader, you're gonna say, you know what? My quarterly profits gonna go down. 15% is way above than my margin. I'm not ready to do that. So the delivery system is the problem.
Mm. And so it's kind of interesting that you say that, because that's actually why we call the podcast Healthy Wealthy with an I, right? Twice an I, because they're so intertwined. And you know, I think I've been a bit naive over the last 30 years being in this field, because I always thought, you know, when people see the benefits, let's say preventive lifestyle medicine, health coaching, and, you know, living healthy. I mean, you live longer, better, are happier, you know, better quality of life. For the people who just say, yeah, sure, that's what I want to do. And I think it's way more complex than that. And I think that's why we talk, and it's going to be a lot of discussions, and, you know, and I know a lot of other organizations and leaders, we need to fix this. We need to find a way to, is it to take money out of healthcare, or at least reframe the importance of money? And if you talk about money, I think it's important to, you know, we all have to make a living. I think that's not the point. But isn't it the control of a few organizations, or however you want to call it, right? Whoever that is, that run the show, and not really to the benefit of people.
Yeah. So, and, you know, I agree. I mean, the thing is, like, in any situation, right? In any scenario of life. See, we as a social being, human, the reason we have survived ice age and dinosaurs and all that is our ability to collaborate. We learn to live in tribes and groups, and, you know, we work together, right? So the thing is, that's what we need to learn from, you know, that unless and until we collaborate, unless and until we understand where the other person is coming from and what are the incentives for that person in this situation, I think we won't be able to negotiate. Right now, because, you know, I work on both sides of the aisle. I believe that, you know, it has to be inclusive. The solution has to be inclusive, right? So we need to start dialogue. What I'm saying that, yes, we all have to make our living, and that's why we, you know, this is a huge motivation that we do what we do, right? But the thing is, if we can, the markets or the few controller, like what we talk about, that few people are controlling, basically, it's an open market, right? It's an market, you know, industry are market driven. These people think of what people are looking for. Let's fulfill the need at some level. You know, one can argue that, yeah, there are, like, you know, Facebooks and you know, Twitters of time create markets, and Apples of time, they create market. They go and they work on the where you're most vulnerable, most weak, right? So that's why they capture, you know, the model. There's nothing wrong to be connected on the Facebook, but the model is such that it makes you keep engaged, keep going into it. And what is the number one commodity nowadays is human attention, right? It is more valuable than time. So they're smart people. They understand how to capture that attention. What I'm saying, if the market demands that, you know, I need you to spend money on the prevention rather than the disease care, they will do that. They'll pivot that. It is all about market driven. So I think it is a complex, you can't oversimplify the whole thing. I mean, you know, one can argue that, okay, how can we change the market, you know, demands and all that. And I think that's what you are doing, or I'm trying to do that, or people like you who are trying to change the demand, you know. And there is, and you can see that there is a, there's a lot of discussion around wellness. And, you know, when we'll discuss about value-based care, you know, they all agree on that, that we do need to prevent, we do need to, you know, we have, they are agreed that current system is not sustainable. No country in the world can sustain it all alone. So we need to do something about it. Now, how to monetize it, that's where we are not agreeable yet, you know.
Yeah, and I think I'm so with you on that, that basically, you know, what 80%+ of all the healthcare cost is spent on chronic health issues. And traditionally, we've not been very successful, you know, to handle or even to prevent, to stop, to reverse these chronic health issues, you know, heart disease, diabetes, obesity, and tons of others. And I think that's one of the problems, you know, how can this be integrated into healthcare? And I'm not sure anymore if it can. That's a whole nother discussion to have. But how can we do that now? But let's go into, I think, what a lot of our listeners are interested in, this pay for service model versus the value based care. Because a few years ago, I mean, I heard about it, but I didn't get how deeply different this really is. So can you talk first about the pay for service? And in the title of this podcast is, you know, why the pay for service model is part of the problem.
No, so traditionally, historically speaking, the care model in the United States is fee for service or pay for service means, we also call it is encounter based. So again, going back to into the little bit of detail of payment system, the delivery system, right? So it is an establishment where a payer, which is Medicare, which is federal government, it's saying that if you're going to see patient face to face in your office or in the hospital or in a nursing, they're point of service. So one thing is point of service, one is encounter. And these are the criteria that if you do take history and physical, you do examination, you order tests, you prescribe treatment, you order, you know, other radiology and other things, I will pay you this much amount. Medicare is saying to providers, right? If you do more, if you go and do a colonoscopy, if you take the patient to the OR and replace the joint or something else, I will pay you this much. So the whole system is based on encounter. If you're going to do something, you're going to get payment for that. It is a simple, you know, simple in a simplistic form. The payment method is dependent on encounter, on the service that you provide. In a nursing home, if you host the patient overnight, this much I'm going to pay you. In a hospital, if you keep the patient in ICU, I'll pay you this much. If you keep it on the regular floor, I'll pay you this much. If you prescribe this kind of medicine, I'll pay you this much. And this medicine, I'll pay you this much, right? So everything is based on encounter or service. So that is design. That is the fundamental design for fee-for-service, right? So guess what? I mean, anybody can say, if you have a business and you are running a hospital, what would be, you know what, Southwest tagline? Southwest, you know, one of the successful airline in US, you know, its tagline, I think I made it up, but I heard about it. I don't know if it's a real tagline, but that's how the business is. It's called butts in the seats, right? It's a simple model, right? That's fee for service, butts in the seat. The more people sits on the seats, the industry will make more money, right? That's why, so, and same thing with the hospitals. It's called heads in the beds. Heads in the beds, right? There is a famous saying in healthcare industry, no margins, no mission. So the thing is, that's fee for service for you. Heads in the, I mean, I think that's the best tagline, heads in the bed.
So is it that basically encouraging, as you said, the more patients I have, the more symptoms I have, maybe even create new ones that I didn't have. So it's almost like good for the industry, right? Actually maybe creating new ones. If, you know, I mean, we've seen this so often that, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago, we didn't have that many diseases like we have now from a label perspective.
Because nobody's incentivized for prevention, you know. So I'll give you an example. If I have a patient who is a smoker, right? And if I sit down with him and try to use all my psych tricks or my education from Lifestyle Prescription University, and I spend half an hour with that person to convince him or her to stop smoking, guess how much Medicare is going to pay me?
I'm curious. Tell me, please.
From nothing, because most of the time, the code that we use for smoking cessation, it doesn't get approved. It has so many connotations attached to it that I need a whole staff geared towards it, which is going to cost me an arm and a leg. So I may get like $14 from Medicare in fee-for-service model. However, if the same patient, by smoking cigarettes for so many years, develop bronchogenic carcinoma, guess what the payment on one bronchogenic average carcinoma for Medicare? Approximately $500,000. You know, all stakeholders, radiology will get money, biopsy surgeon will get money, lobectomy surgeon get money, hospital will get money, radiation oncologist will get money, your chemotherapy guys will get money, rehabilitation will guys get money. I mean, maybe more than $500,000, right? So that is the system.
So $14 for prevention, yeah, and $500,000 once we waited long enough. Finally, mm-hmm, the client or the patient is really sick, and then it's $500,000.
Yeah. So insane.
Can you give another example? Because that's, I think, shocking. I mean, I think people don't know. I mean, right? I mean, because it's so convoluted and most of us don't get the bill because insurance pays for it. Can you give a couple more of these examples? Because I think that is so revealing where we at and the kind of problem we have. Yeah. And let me say one thing before we do that. Because it affects everyone. I mean, it's the premiums, you know, right? 1,000, 2,000 per person or a family, right? I mean, it's incredible. People, companies going bankrupt because they cannot afford it anymore. So this is important, guys. Everybody out there, please, we have to pay attention to this. So can you give more examples of this incredible imbalance between $14 for preventing smoking and the symptoms that might follow versus $500,000 being paid in terms of healthcare expenses if somebody has more serious health issue, yeah, caused by smoking and maybe other factors?
So many. I mean, I have so many examples. Like almost every chronic disease is an example. These are all preventable diseases, right? That's what we call it. Chronic diseases are preventable diseases, you know. Take an example of cardiovascular disease, right? So now, like with my Dean Ornish program that I have, Dr. Dean Ornish has to get approval from the research at the CMS. And it's very nice that he got that. It's amazing that he has his own like diagnostic codes, but it is approved as a cardiac rehabilitation measure or encounter. It is a cardiac rehab. So my center is a cardiac rehab center. So it has an inclusion criteria, right? So like any, if you are enrolling under Medicare, any patient, it has to come under a criteria that if the patient does not follow that criteria, it's not going to be approved. Medicare is not going to pay. So that inclusion criteria, Jonas, is basically after the fact, right? If there is an evidence of coronary artery disease. So what are the evidence? Patient already had an MI, heart attack, right? Or patient has an angiogram done, which shows blockages and all that, certain EKG changes also included and all that, but there is an evidence needed, right? Even then, I think it's a great idea that if we can include these patients, and Dr. Dean Ornish program cost Medicare somewhere in the range of $7,000 to $8,000, for example. So think of it, we know the risk factors of coronary artery disease. We know that atherosclerosis starts way early in life. We know that scientifically. It's not a speculation or, wishful thinking or something. We know this happened, right? But the thing is, if we go to Medicare and say, listen, this patient has diabetes, has obesity, doesn't exercise, is smoke, and high cholesterol, blood pressure, stress, depression, we know this patient is going to end up with CAD, right? Why don't you let him include into Dr. Dean Ornish program? Because, okay, $7,000, for example, but if that, and we don't get approval for that, right? But if that patient once end up in the hospital with chest pain, so the average cost of just admission and doing one angioplasty and one stent goes up to $40,000 to $50,000, one admission, right? So the thing is, but we know that they never stay after. So what happened after, even if you put the stent, you go to the emergency room, and this, God bless our cardiologists. They are very skilled and they do a great job. They wake up at 3 a.m. to take that emergency that is coming in, and they go and they do angiogram and, almost save the dying patient, because most of the time, heart attack that we call it, it is your 30, 40% atheroma that breaks suddenly, like one cigarette can do that, or a stressful encounter at home or something like that. It breaks the atheroma and become 100%. So these cardiologists, they go in, they open it up, they put the stent, save the life, all that. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, what we fail to tell our patients, even cardiologists, that listen, your disease is not fixed. I open the artery and you have time that you can live, but your disease is still there. Every reason that caused the atheroma there on the first place is still there. So, the thing is, so that patient end up again and again in the hospital, then that patient will have another stent after 1 or 2 years. Then that patient finally have open heart surgery. Right. Then with open heart surgery, if the ejection fraction is below like 20%, that patient will have a defibrillator implanted in that. All those medication that is hundreds and thousands of dollars. So in that lifetime, because of that cardiovascular, we're talking about easily $500,000 to $600,000 versus maybe $6,000 that we can prevent in the program.
Yeah. I think the data is out there. It's just kind of buried and most people don't talk about it, right? And I think we really need to talk about this because, it affects all of us, as I said before. So we know, okay, fee for service is the model we have right now. Now let's switch into value-based care. Can you first talk about how does that work? And then we kind of dive into examples, right? How would that look like really in practice?
So if by definition, there's no specific definition of value-based care. If you look at the site of Cleveland Clinic, you will have a different definition. If you look at Harvard, you will find a different definition of value-based care. Any institution, Johns Hopkins, you will find it. Why? because it's so in fancy in a way, you know, like the thought processes and, you know, we are not like the consensus is not there 100% because it's still people are, it's more of a theory and ideas for the future. However, if you combining, you know, all looking at all the definitions and description of value-based, there are three things which are common to all. One is you want to increase the patient outcome, improve, you want to improve the patient outcome, better outcome. So number one thing, what it means that it should be patient-centered. So the care should be, just look at the definition. The care should be patient-centered. So you think about it that our care was not patients, and this is an admission.
I was about to say, shouldn't that be the case anyway?
Exactly. So, well, that's the, you know, that's value-based. It's by definition, care should be patient-centered. However, so just to give you, because right now the fee-for-service is mainly centered around provider and institution, actually. A lot of things, and you know, there is a detail into it, why it is being said and all that, but so number one, it should be patient-centered and the improving the outcome of, so health outcome, now how are we gonna define health outcomes, right? And that's the detail about it. And so the increasing value for the patient, for example, so improving the value, what does this patient want, right? If, you know, again, if you really go one step deeper, you will see that what is more valuable for patient, an exercise program under Ornish where you meet people, you chit chat, you know, have good connection, you're happy, or go under an open heart surgery.
Let me think for a second here. So yeah, I have a good time, exercise, eat healthy, and, you know, just feel better. Mm-hmm. Or I go into the hospital and have open heart surgery. I'm not sure, Dr. Yamani, which one I would love more.
But it is so amazing, Johannes, that a typical patient does not mind going under open heart surgery. That is the thing, yes. Because you know why? Because they think that's the normal. They have no other option. It is a learned behavior. So market has been created for years and years and decades that a typical person, they actually brag about it, that my open heart surgery was done by such and such surgeon. You know?
Okay, let me ask something, because see, this is just from my point of view, my mindset, it's just so hard to believe because I'm in the field for such a long time, 30, 35 years. So it's like I'm in this alternate reality, right? Like, you know, that we talk a lot about these days. Now, there is wellness, health information everywhere, right? I mean, since the internet over the last 10 years, it's everywhere, right? And there's thousands and thousands of books and new books every week or whatever. How can people still not know? Or let me ask another way. Why is there such a disconnect between the information, the books, the articles online, right, that we have in healthcare? Because I hear it so often, where, especially the last 2 years, I think we could even follow it more. Yeah, I've been living healthy and I do this and that and exercise, you know, great. But then when we're confronted with a symptom, we kind of throw it out the door and say, oh, yes, I want this heart surgery. Now, let me preframe it. Obviously, in many cases, it's needed, but we're trying to look at the big picture here, right? Why aren't there no options? Yeah. I don't understand. Why is that the case? Why are there no options right now?
I think that one word come to my mind is culture. We have, you know, when the society, you know, our external triggers are very strong, right? There's something called in psychology norm matching. Right. So if I'm in a restaurant and I, you know, we are like 6-7 people, and then I'm going to order something that my next person has ordered before me, right? If that person wants soup, I'm saying, okay, well, bring me the soup, you know, that, right? So it's a human need. I mean, these are smart people. They understand the human psychology more than that. But these, you know, I'll give you an example of how corporation and businesses run the whole culture thing, right? There was a time after, you know, like just after the Second World War in US, they were not able to recruit young cadets because of the gum diseases. They, you know, they come and they would fail physical examination because they have gingivitis and gum disease. And they were like troubling why people would not brush. They don't brush their teeth and all that. You know, there was no culture of brushing teeth in the United States. So this young businessman, you know, he wanted to come up with a toothpaste. And he says that, you know, maybe I'm going to solve the pain of the society by having this toothpaste. But he didn't have the distribution channel. You know, he had no idea how to get it to people and all that. So he went to his friend, and I'm forgetting the names. I mean, those are famous names in the United States, right? So he went to his friend, and who's an excellent in the marketing and everything. And he says, you know, I have this toothpaste and it will solve the issue for our gum disease and all that. And people don't. So, you know, the marketing person says, forget about it. You know, I have a very good reputation. The businesses that I put my hand in, you know, they all, so this is a field that I don't want to go into because there's no market. People don't brush. So I go with you in this business and then we're going to fail and it's going to be bad on my resume. I'm not doing that. He says, no, please do that. He was a good friend and all that. And he promised 50% of the company. He said, I'll give you 50%. He says, okay. I mean, maybe the pros and cons, he'll take it. But you know what he did he looked at the formula and he says, okay, I should have a permission to change the formula. He says, okay. And he added peppermint to the paste, which has nothing to do with teeth cleaning. But every morning when you brush it, that oil gives you that sense of cleanliness. It is the perception, Joannes. It is the perception. So that's how you, and that become, you know, the P&G, one of the biggest distributor of the product of the, you know, that in the United States. I mean, and you saw that results were there. People started, you know, brushing because of the reward thing. So we have that short end of the stick because what we are seeing, a common person is not seeing the reward. It's very easy to pop a pill than to go for a 15 minutes session of yoga. Yeah. So the thing is, the results is in the culture, but what I'm seeing, these markets are being made intentionally based on the incentives. So it's in a way, if we find the incentives for these smart people and we can show them, you know, you can still make money, but making them healthy in the process. So I believe it's possible.
Can you, great examples. Can you talk a bit more about the value-based care? I mean, in terms of how would that look like in healthcare, right? And I think that what you said just a minute ago, it's about incentives, right? So health professionals and patients, people, are not really incentivized to live healthy and prevent. Look at that lifestyle, which we know is the major causative factor of chronic health issues that we have. So how would that look like, and how could these incentives happen?
So that's what value-based care is doing. I mean, I think a pleasant surprise to all of us that exactly was value-based care is. So number one, I know we got sidetracked with the value and all that. I'll try to stay the course, which is, you know, so number one thing with value-based care is increase the value for the patient, outcome, improve outcome, number one. Number two is cost, reduce the cost of care. And number three, be competitive. These are the three aspects of value-based care among all the definitions so far. So, you know, it is kind of a, it is a very you can say integrated system, where which is driven primarily by the payers, right? Which is Medicare and other health, you know, Medicare Advantage plans, as we call it here. So, so basically, what you're and there are different models so far. New models are keep coming in a way. Some models really are successful, like MA plans, which is called Medicare Advantage plan. There are accountable care organizations, which is part of the value-based care. There are, you know, it's called direct contracting. So there are different formulas in the mix right now, right? What I practice is Medicare Advantage, value-based, which is defined as Medicare Advantage plan. So my payer sources are Medicare Advantage plans and all that. But it, so the thing is, you need data, you need robust. So there are different components of this care. One is like data integration. So, you know, really accumulating all that data. Right now, I would say we are in the phase of data collection. Severity of illness, what kind of symptoms can lead to what kind of diseases, what's the time period, what's the cost to that? These are all wonderful data is being collected as we speak right now, right? Every day, that's what, you know, then we stratify the risk of patients, you know, like who is healthy patient? So if they're healthy, what kind of care they need? At that time, they need more integration. They need more like exercise activities, lifestyle modifications, availability. If they get like pre-chronic disease thing, different interventions. If they're chronic, two or more chronic diseases, different interventions. If they have depression to the mix, completely different interventions needed. So we are defining, we're stratifying patients, patients who are really sick, different intervention. Then you have like a measure, you know. In fee-for-service, there is no incentive of measuring and all that. So now we are measuring our outcomes, right? If we did this intervention, if the patient come for primary care visit, what are the chances of preventing the disease? If the patients follow lifestyle modification, measurement. So by data, by technology, now the measurement is the key. Then you have, you know, care delivery system. Then you have, you know, dealing with health plans and payers and how to do contracting. Then what is the role in the community? You know, how what community services and what we call it now, the buzzword is social determinant of health, you know. So what kind of aspects are determining patients' health? Everything is being addressed in value-based care. And now we are not getting paid based on encounters. We are getting paid on what value we are generating, means outcomes. So we only make money if we keep people healthy in value-based care.
Well, can you say that again? Because I think that's so refreshingly new that people yes. want to hear that again.
Yes. So value-based care is based on the incentive is to keep patients healthy. So the more you're going to keep healthy, the more money you're going to make.
Is that similar to this old Chinese kind of story where actually doctors, and I don't know if how true that is, I know it's true, but when that was, I don't know, a long time ago, that doctors get only paid if clients are healthy. If not, they're sick, they don't get paid. Is that kind of like that metaphor?
It's more than that. If they're sick, it's out of our pocket. Yes.
Well, that gets people's attention, right?
So basically, it's a two-way up and down risk. You have options. Okay, because I've been doing it for some time, and you know, I started with, you know, these kind of lifestyle. So the thing is, the whole system. What I realized that yes, the payers are ready to reward you for good performance, but there is still nothing much. At the patient's level, what they do at home, to me, that's the real risk management. We buy secondary insurance on the money side of it to prevent us from, you know, from high risk, because, you know, one patient can cost you the whole, because the hospitals are not in the game yet, right? Mm. Hospitals will still bill fee for service. They're not entirely, there are some models of ACO. We are hospital part of the whole conglomeration, but we still see a lot of resistance from the hospital sides, right? But a lot of hospitals are like Cleveland Clinic is way up there on wellness. Because why? Because they're self-insured. So they have a wellness program for their own employees. They know that, you know, we want to keep them healthy. So we don't want to, you know, go them to the hospital and all this. So for their own employee, Cleveland Clinic have wellness program. So all the self-insured people, companies love to have wellness program in their system.
Now, I know that I've read that, you know, this value-based medicine also has a lot of criticism that basically if not used ethically, and like, you know, I can see in you how you are so into like, oh my God, how can I help my clients? And I often say like friends that I know are just these doctors that are just so passionate about helping people. I think most of the doctors are, right? And I say, oh, we always need to clone them. We need millions of them. Like we clone you. but the criticism, I think, is also, well, you could use this system, value-based medicine, to basically just don't treat people or less and just so you save. You know, is there something to it?
Yeah, so that used to be like maybe I would say 20 years ago, because at that time we used to call it managed care, you know. So like I want to say to the critics, and you know, where the most of the critics come from, hospital people, you know, and the specialists, because specialists is not the game yet in that. It's only for primary care, right? So the thing is, again, your incentives makes your beliefs, you know, that's what it is. You believe in something, but you're incentivized and all that. So the thing is, that used to be, that 20, 30 years ago, it used to call it managed care. And it was, you know, if you're assigned healthy patient, of course your outcome is gonna be to mitigate that. Medicare come up with this stratification. So Medicare is saying you cannot have only healthy, first of all, in a population, you cannot design it, right? You have to take care of everything. So now Medicare has a different level. If you take care of sicker patient, actually you make more money because you take bigger challenge, right? So, you know, if there is a risk, higher the risk, higher the reward, you know, that kind of thing. So if you take on bigger challenge and you do a good job, you actually end up, you know, because Medicare assign higher number of dollar to sicker population. So this is called, you know, risk adjustment. So because of risk adjustment, that notion is out of the window. That, you know, we actually, the more we seek now complicated patients, because that's the challenge actually. Yeah, that's right.
This is amazing. Yeah. Now, maybe because I think still for a lot of the listeners, you know, maybe the doctors that are listening, primary care or a specialist or even other healthcare professionals, do you see this growing, this value-based approach? And how could somebody get involved in a sense that what are the steps needed to maybe change a practice towards value-based medicine?
So yeah, the answer to the first question is growing. You know, it's growing like leaps and bounds, right? Federal government assigned, you know, almost like $900 billion in next 5 years for this program too. And partly, you know, what we are thinking in the field that we are in the phase of data collection. So it is possible that massively reform come that all primary care will be value-based. There will be no other possibility to practice medicine, you know, as at a primary care level. I'm not saying about consultants and hospitals yet, but you know, it's the model is so simple and makes sense that I don't know why it is not done yet. So people who are still struggling and debating, they're gonna enter the kingdom, you know, shouting and yelling, but they still have to then. So it's better to adopt now. Yes, it's a change, you know. So change is hard, not because people don't want to change, but because of the sense of loss. Nobody wants to lose, right? That's why people are resistant. So I say to all of our listener, study, learn. It's not a rocket science. It's much easier than the medicine that they have studied, right? So the thing is, now what they can do to change, is if they're in a private practice or in a hospital setting or in a group setting, ask your people who negotiate contracts to go to health plans and ask them, what do you have for value in the value-based product lines for us? What if we improve our quality? Can you reward us on that? What if we improve our documentation? How are we gonna get rewarded? So even if the fundamental contract, so in a way, there you can skin the cat in many ways, right? So if your fundamental contract is still fee for service and you don't want to take a risk, and I would not, if I have to come in now in the game, I would take some, you know, baseline. So you take the baseline of fee for service, but you layer on it ideas of added value, you know. So if you kind of work at a wellness program in your system, if you bring that wellness program to your office, to your practice, there are health plans who will reward you for that per patient, per month sort of thing. So there are ways to incorporate those changes, integrations. So, you know, improve your documentation, improve your technology, electronic medical records is a necessity for that, things like that.
Yeah, and I think over time here at the podcast, Healthy Wealthy Podcast, we're going to talk a lot more about that, you know, like, and that's kind of where we go into the healthcare 3.0. I mean, I personally believe there have to be new models that, you know, I mean, gosh, we've been so innovative, you know, worldwide. Of it, just look at technology, and it still feels like, yes, we do a lot of upgrading with medical records and all this kind of stuff, super new diagnostics tool. But at its core, healthcare is still the same, basically, like what, the last 50 to 100 years or so. And I think we need to really look at new options. Do you kind of agree, or? What do you say
totally,
about that?
Totally agree. Yeah. I mean, I think the change can come within, right? If we change the incentives, people are, you know, a doctor and a healthcare program, they're all, you know, like the front line is always have good intention to, and they want to see their patients getting better. If I'm prescribing a prescription drug, or I'm sending patient to the Ornish program, my idea is to have better outcome. I mean, you know, so I think that we need to believe that. With this belief, we need to integrate and, you know, work together in that.
Love that. Thank you so much, Dr. Yamani. I know we could go on and on, but I think this is a great start, and I hope we can talk about not just the how we practice, right? Because we talked a lot about that, like pay for service, which basically is part of the problem, right? Versus the value-based health outcome, which is, I have to laugh, you know, because to me that should be the obvious reason why to switch to value-based type of medicine. But also the delivery, right? What kind of treatments, what's the model we use for the delivery, which obviously for you in a big way is lifestyle medicine and health coaching, and for us obviously too, which is a big part of this podcast. So I hope we can do that soon, and thanks so much. Some last call to action for our listeners.
So basically, you know, I think it starts with self. So, you know, with my providers that, you know, when I talk to my doctors and, you know, my team, you know, they often say, oh, but, you know, it's very hard. Patients are not going to accept that. I always request them, do you accept that? Are you ready to practice lifestyle medicine and look into the root cause analysis in your own life and your loved one? And I think that's where it starts.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And to our listeners out there, please click the follow or the subscribe button on the podcast, whatever channel you use, and share. You know, that's what we need to do. We need to talk. We need to discuss. We need to also ask critical questions, you know, and be okay with that, you know, because that's when new ideas pop up, because we have these conversations. So please share. And more exciting experts and podcasts going to be available very, very soon. Thanks again, Dr. Yamani.
Thank you. Appreciate it. See you.